Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm Heather Vogel, one of the reporters at ProPublica who covers education, and I'm talking today with Nicole Hannah-Jones, a former ProPublica reporter who's now a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Recently, the magazine published a story Nicole wrote about the public school where her daughter attends in New York City, PS 307. The school is somewhat unusual for the child of a magazine writer at a major publication. It is substantially populated by poor children of color coming from nearby housing projects. It also became the site of a recent flare-up of neighborhood tension when predominantly white and well-off parents living nearby were pushed into its school zone to ease crowding at another elementary school nearby. Nicole has spent much of the past 4 years chronicling how official actions and policies perpetuate racial and economic segregation in our nation's housing and schools. For this story, she also found herself writing about her own family and the painful choices parents of school children are left to make in the absence of an official effort to right past wrongs. Thanks so much for coming onto our podcast, Nicole.
Thanks for having me, Heather.
So obviously you knew from the beginning that you were basically living an experience that was something that you'd been writing about on a broader level for years. But I'm interested in what moment when you decided to write about it. I was wondering whether the rezoning dispute in particular had really brought into stark relief the problems that you were watching and had this incredible context knowing about.
Yeah, so I was not going to write about my daughter's school at all when we made the decision to enroll her there. It was a personal decision, and I didn't intend to write about it. I started attending the rezoning meetings, and I still wasn't going to write about it. I just didn't feel journalistically that I should be writing about something that's on my beat and that I'm so close to. And it wasn't until after the national media started covering the story and I was reading a lot of the accounts, and I just felt that there was a story that wasn't being told. And understandably, because, you know, newspaper reporters and TV reporters have very short time to turn around something. They don't have a lot of space. They have to move on to other things. But I felt we were writing about all of these tensions and this difficulty without giving any context about why we were here and what was making this so hard, and why in this very liberal city we were grappling with race no better than anywhere else. I kept going back and forth in my mind about whether I was going to write about it. One day I'd be like, no. And then, you know, all journalists know you have those stories that kind of won't leave you alone that you keep thinking about. So that's when I went in and told my editor that I thought I should write about it.
Was that all happening around the same time as your daughter was transitioning from pre-K into kindergarten? You had a more mixed pre-K experience than you did a kindergarten experience, right? A lot of the parents left. I was wondering how much that experience, sort of being the one left standing in a way with the other children from the projects and then some other children coming from your neighborhood, from Bed-Stuy also. Right. How did that, I guess, impact you and your view of what was happening and sort of make real what you were writing about, really? Was there a feeling of abandonment a little bit?
So my daughter's class was probably about half white. And then there were several biracial children in there, and then some black kids. And it was very mixed in terms of probably about half or more of the class was middle class, and the remainder of the class was coming from the Farragut houses. There were also Asian students. My daughter formed very close relationships with those students, birthday parties and play dates and things like that. And then towards the end of the school year, when parents start having these discussions about what are you doing next year, we just slowly started hearing one by one of the parents saying they weren't coming back for various reasons. Some parents said they were coming back, and we found out on the first day of school when my daughter shows up, and there are literally only two kids from her last class still there. It wasn't that surprising because I know that oftentimes in these segregated schools, white parents and middle-class parents will enroll their kids in the early grades, but then soon those kids will be taken out for older grades. I didn't know that I thought it would happen. I mean, usually they at least stay through kindergarten. So that was pretty surprising. It was also surprising, I guess, how uncomfortable people were with that choice, that it was clear these were not choices that a lot of parents were necessarily proud of because they were very evasive about whether they were coming back or not. So I think there was a sense that they felt they were also abandoning something or that they were making a more selfish choice. I'm not going to say whether they were or not, because every choice you make about your child is in some ways selfish and necessarily so. But it definitely had me thinking about how inequality gets replicated in this way.
And it made you want to write about that, about the nuance and the complexity of the decisions that individual people are making and the big impact they're having on the bigger system?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the big difference between being a reporter who writes about public education with no children in school and being a reporter who now is having to navigate this system herself makes a big difference in how you understand people's choices. You also see the interior of a school in a way that you don't see it as a reporter. My husband and I are trying to figure out what are we going to do with our own daughter and dealing with our own conflict about it. I mean, I always understood just from interviewing parents how difficult this choice was, but clearly you get a different, you see it in a different way when you also can personally understand how tough these decisions are and also how the larger system really does feel like it constrains your choices.
So how did your reporting process differ since you were living this as you were reporting it?
That was hard to navigate in some ways. I mean, the hardest part of that to navigate was inside the school. Outside the school, that was just my typical reporting process. But, you know, I had been privy to conversations. People had said things to me when they weren't saying them to a reporter. They were saying them to a parent. So it was definitely I had to go back to everyone and say, I've now decided that I'm going to write on this story. I'm not going to use any conversations that were had without talking to you about it first. But from now on, you should know I'm going to let you know when I'm reporting, when I'm here as a parent, when I'm reporting. It was hard. I think navigating that was hard. I think our principal definitely got nervous after that, understandably, and making sure that the lines were always very clear between when I was here as a parent and when I was there as a reporter. I never spent a ton of time in the school because I travel a lot for work. My husband spent a lot more time in the school than me. So I don't think because of that my presence as a reporter changed a great deal inside the school because I wasn't the parent who was there every day anyway. But it was definitely a challenge. I mean, it was a challenge, you know, with my own husband to go back and say, you know, these really personal conversations that we had, I have to write about them. I have to include them in the piece or it's not honest. But that's not what he signed up for either. We were two parents who were having a discussion. And so him having to admit that he also had fear about enrolling our daughter in those schools, that wasn't an easy conversation. But he also believed it was important and also important to show that the fear he had was unfounded, which the piece also shows. But this was a very tricky piece. I've done some personal essay before, but nothing like this.
What was his initial reaction when you started talking about writing about it and writing about the conversation?
He wanted me to write about it. But I think, as we know with sources, it's one thing to, like, talk about something. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to see it written down. So the first time I kind of was showing him, this is what I'm saying about our conversations, there was some discomfort. And he was like, well, I hope you say, you know, I totally changed my mind and I became completely active in the school and tried to work for those kids. And I'm like, of course I'll say that. But I think this is a hard thing. But I also think that is why, of all of the pieces I've written, it's very damning, but it's also the most nuanced look at why we have so much segregation, even with, you know, a city full of well-meaning people.
Now, talk about the decision to put your daughter in the spotlight. How did you sort through all the pros and cons and where you're going to draw the boundaries and how you were going to make those decisions? One thing I noticed was that, for instance, she's on the cover of the story. Mm-hmm. She's right there, and you sort of see her in all of her six-year-oldness. And yet, the story is very clearly about the adults and about the system and about everything that's happening around these children.
That's right.
And in a way, there's still sort of a bubble around her and her sort of youthful experiences. It's not a story about a child starting school.
Right.
Really. It's about something else. And so can you talk about, as a writer, how you sorted through all of that and figured out how to approach that?
So it wasn't until probably maybe a month and a half, 2 months max before the story ran. I started reporting the story full-time in October, that even the conversation about putting my daughter on the cover came up. I don't think that was the original intent, and I certainly didn't think she was going to be on the cover. So I was fairly comfortable because, like you said, it gives very little detail about her. The story is really not about her. So I was comfortable with her being in the story, but I definitely had a very visceral reaction when they said, we've decided we would like to put your daughter on the cover of the magazine. Initially, I said no. And then I talked it over with my husband, and he was all for it. And I didn't understand why he didn't have the reservations that I had, because my reservations were, you know, she's six. She doesn't really have a say. I mean, she doesn't understand what it is that she's doing, and she's basically becoming the face of segregation. But also, I'm fairly public. I'm a fairly public figure. And so just opening up her to that. I think what changed my mind, or why I ultimately allowed it to happen, were a couple things. One, I realized in some ways I felt a little hypocritical, like I am asking other parents to do this all the time. Part of our job as education reporters is we need photographs of kids. We're investigative reporters, so we need photographs of kids who have gone through bad circumstances, and we're asking parents to put their children as a face of whatever issue it is. So to then be like, because I'm in this powerful position as the writer, I'm going to say no about my own child, even though clearly she is really the only child in the story. And the other thing was, 2 years ago, I did this story called Ghosts of Greenwood. And I was talking to the civil rights activist who pretty much designed Freedom Summer. And he said that at some point, they understood that they had to bring white students into the movement, because black students and black civil rights workers were being murdered and brutalized, and no one cared. And he said, we had to bring white students in because we knew America would see through their eyes what they couldn't see through ours. And that is always, like, that has haunted me. And I get emotional even thinking about it now. I guess I, in the end, thought, if they can see this little girl, a girl that they can relate to more for class reasons or for whatever reasons, will they then be able to finally relate to all of these children who are suffering for our decisions, and who adults are making decisions for and about, and putting them in situations they don't deserve. So ultimately, that was the reason why I finally said okay, is I felt the small sacrifice of her anonymity was worth if people could make a connection to all of these other children through her. And she was actually, like, really pumped.
So, you know, your view of what was happening in the school, how did that evolve over time as you began to see it through a writer's eyes versus just a parent's eyes? And did you find yourself taking a little bit of a step back and having a little bit more of a clinical view versus, I know this was a very sort of warm and nurturing place for your daughter in pre-K and continued to be right. So in kindergarten. But as you were seeing all these different sort of forces that were pushing and pulling on the edges, how did that change as you were looking at it with a writer? Has your emotional relationship with the school changed?
I don't think my emotional relationship with the school changed. I think that it is a school that is doing very well with what it has. I clearly also see how the school struggles with such a high concentration of poverty, and now with a new principal who has never been a principal before, which is a very typical thing that happens at these schools. And we also know that that school had gotten where it was because of the principal, and that in these high poverty schools, the principal is everything. And then she retires. And now we have a woman who's very committed, but who has never run a school before. And so I see all of those things, and I understand what that means because we've reported on this for such a long time. I don't ever think I'm emotionally disconnected from my work, which I know a lot of journalists don't believe we should say that, but it's just true, and I'm just honest, and I think if you read my work, there's always a level of outrage in there. I think I did try much harder, and this is part, my editor was also pushing me on this, to understand, like, the white parents in PS8, what their fears were. But also really trying to push and say it's not a matter that they're just racist and they don't want to be in integrated schools, because clearly you would not be in New York City public schools if you didn't want your kids around any black and Latino kids. That is not the case. You would be somewhere else. You would either move out to the suburbs or you would be in private school. I think what working on this story helped me to frame better the challenges in such a broken system, and how clearly we know poor black and Latino parents' choices are very, very constrained. But that also middle class and white parents' choices are constrained in a different way, and not in a way that's hurtful to them, but their choices are still constrained. Like the clinical eye to, like, what is the system that these parents are making this choice in, and how hard is it to ask them to do something that they really do believe will hurt their child? Whether that fear is justified or not, it is a real fear. I think that that is definitely something that I got out of it as I just began really reporting.
Did that leave you feeling more helpless about these problems or more hopeful? How did that change how you viewed the big context of resegregation?
I don't think it changed it. I don't think it made me more hopeful or less hopeful. You know, I'm not an optimist about this in general. And I knew that once a school system becomes so segregated, integration does become a very challenging thing to do. I think, if anything, it was a gratifying experience to me because I had been wanting to write about segregation in this way for a while. And I'd been wanting to write about segregation up north for a while. In that sense, to be able to kind of dispel that myth about Northern progressivism, or the myth that segregation is a problem of the racist South, or that you even have to be racist to uphold a segregated system, I think that that was very important for me to do.
We were talking about the principal, and you know, it really seems she's a testament to how great leadership can make a difference for a school, especially on this issue, because she can connect with parents and perhaps help alleviate some of their anxieties if they're unfounded. And it sounds like she had an incredible program going at the school. I know she's left now, but maybe you can just talk a little bit more about that dynamic and what you learned about it through experiencing it and writing about it.
As you know, whenever we have seen a school with these demographics doing well, or at least relatively well for the demographics of the school, it's always because there is a dynamic principal, always. And we all know how important principals are to any school, but particularly in a school with a very vulnerable population. So she was clearly that type of person. I'll be honest, like, when I was looking at a school, I'm not worried about test scores. I really was most worried about school environment. I wanted my daughter to be in a place, one, where she would be nurtured. She was, you know, 4 years old when I was sending her away. And I wanted a place where the kids looked happy, because you go into so many of these schools, these high poverty schools, and it's like the kids are being punished because they can't score high on a test. They don't have recess and they don't have art. And even in class, it's just rote learning, and the kids aren't getting to do all the things that middle class parents expect and demand for their children. The kids who need that joy the most are deprived of it. So I was looking at, what's the art on the walls? Like, how are the teachers teaching in the classroom? Do the children look like they want to be there? When I met Ms. Davenport, she was just clearly extremely nurturing, but also very clear that she believed these kids deserve no less than any other kid, and she was going to do everything she could. The problem with that is, which I talk about in the piece, is we also know, like, that is not sustainable. Principals at these schools almost always burn out because they're having to work tremendous amount of hours to keep things running like that. Emotionally, it's extremely taxing when you're dealing with kids and families with so many needs. You know it's not sustainable. It's just so precarious. Like, whether or not the most vulnerable kids will get a quality education depends on one person is just silly, and it's wrong. Which is why I always hate when we highlight these exceptional schools, because I think then we say, oh, we don't have to fix this larger problem. We just have to get good principals in there. But it's not enough. And we seldom get the best principals in these schools. Clearly, if these kids were getting, like, the best teachers and the best principals, they could do well. I still think they're being deprived culturally and socially of a lot of other things when they're in segregated schools. But we're not doing that. And we've never had, like, the sustained will to do it. It's usually based on the altruism of an individual principal like Ms. Davenport, who wants to work in these types of schools, who grew up in these types of schools. But it's seldom because a school system is saying, we're going to put our very best in the neediest schools.
Was there a moment when you were afraid the story wasn't coming together? Did you sort of hit a wall at any point? And if so, how did you get through that?
I knew it was a good story, and I knew I was going to tell things that hadn't been told yet. But there was certainly a point in the drafting where I was like, what am I saying? I didn't know that outside of just talking about this one battle, what was the larger story? What was the thing that was going to make people say, I didn't know this, or it's making me think about it in a different way? And I struggled with that. And, you know, this is where the editor-reporter relationship is so important. I really trust my editor. I talked to her about my fears, and we had conversations about what did I want the piece to do and what do we need to do to the piece in terms of structure and writing to really get it there. So we worked through it. At that point, I had invested, like, way too much time reporting and writing, and there was no going back. there was not any way I was going to go to my, you know, editor and be like, let's kill this story.
Right.
So, you know, I had to make it work. But also, as you know, when you spend a long time on things, you don't want a dud. it's one thing if I'm writing, you know, a couple stories a week or a couple stories a month and one of them is not so good. But it's another thing when you've spent 6 months exclusively on one thing, it needs to land well. I had a lot of anxiety about that.
You very deeply researched the history of this school and this place and also the city and the nation, really, in terms of segregation when you were writing this piece and the others that you've written in the last few years. What was the most surprising thing in this more recent round of research that you did, do you think, that you found?
I don't get surprised by a lot because I've been studying this stuff for so long. But there's certain things that just really interest me or that I find really fascinating. And I found the history of the Farragut houses just really fascinating. I went to the archives, the New York City Housing Authority, which runs the public housing in the city. Their archives are located at LaGuardia Community College in Queens, which is one of the things I love to do is like go to archives. And so I looked at all these old tenant rolls and you just see how it really was kind of this vision of what we believe America should be or some people believe America is, which is just all these different people from all these different ethnic groups who were strivers. Their husbands had fought in the war and were clawing themselves into the middle class. We're living in this place. And there's like pictures of President Eisenhower posing with some of the new tenants, which, you know, it's like, can you even imagine a president posing? You know, we want to hide new public housing now. Like, we don't want anyone to know because there'll be so much opposition. But at the time, like, this was the president was here posing with tenants in this new public housing development. And so you just see this period of like hopefulness where we could have gone another way. And then, you know, as the piece shows, then we start to open up these all-white suburbs and get these subsidized loans that only white GIs and white homebuyers can use. And so we have this brief moment, and then we quickly, like, revert to our normal American selves. So I think that was probably, like, the most fascinating part to kind of see that history and literally look at the tenant rolls, and you can see, you know, from year to year, the demographics of Farragut changing from very integrated to within, you know, a few short decades being almost completely segregated.
I want to talk for a couple minutes about something you've brought up a couple times, which is why it's so hard for parents to do the right thing here and elsewhere. I know from my personal experience that when we were living just outside of Atlanta, that we chose the school district we were in large part because it was doing reasonably well and had a very diverse economic and racial mix of kids. When we moved here, we made a lot of decisions very quickly, and I ended up in one of these school districts that is sort of, I forgot how you, the exact words you use, but it's sort of a carefully cultivated,
curated,
ethnic and racial mix, but with very little economic diversity. And, you know, it's not that it hadn't occurred to me before, but reading your piece, it really brought home to me how I'm part of the problem. And so I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about that and why the way things are set up now continue, as you have mentioned, to perpetuate these problems in a city that is known for its progressive thinking.
Right. What I try to lay out in the piece is how inequality at some point just becomes self-replicating, that initially it was created. And that's why I spend so much time in history, because I think it's important for Americans to understand that the inequality we see is not accidental or natural, that it was actually created. But once it is created, and we put a great deal of effort into creating it, which I think people also don't realize. You know, we were busing kids for segregation. We are forcibly segregating kids, even in integrated neighborhoods. We, as a country and as a city, forcibly segregated people in housing. And there was a lot of money and thought and policy put into that, but very little effort to undo it. And now we don't want to spend any time or any money, and we believe it's social engineering to undo it. So I think it's important to understand that once the system is set up, unless it's disrupted, it just replicates. So when you move into a city, people are automatically telling you what neighborhoods you need to move into to get into good schools. Who in their right mind who has choice says, oh, I'm going to pick a house in a neighborhood with a bad school? That's not a natural thing to do. And so you're not an evil person. You're just saying, this is where the good schools are. I'm going to try to move in a place to get my child into that good school. The problem is, then that is also maintaining this larger system of inequality. I think what I've always understood is that if you're depending on individual parents to break down this system on the backs of their own children, you're never going to get very far. That's why the systemic changes are so necessary. The problem is, and this is what you see with PS307 and PS8, is even when the changes are systemic, now parents are fighting those too. So it's a lot harder to excuse when no one's saying you vote with your individual child, but what they're saying is we're going to put a bunch of you kids into the school, which will then be integrated, by the way, and that we're fighting that as well. So it is both an individual and a systemic issue, but we're not doing very well in the systemic issue. But we also don't have good leadership. I mean, part of what my story was also showing is you have this mayor who ran literally on the tail of two cities, who would not touch this issue at all, who could use his bully pulpit, who could talk about this in a moral way and say, you know, I know that you bought a house to be in this area, but this is not the right thing for your community and it's not the right thing for your city. And he could lead and the school's chancellor could lead. And they have largely refused to do that. And I think that leadership for people who are primed to do, who want to do the right thing, but need to know that it's going to be okay, that we haven't seen that leadership at all.
Do you think that a strong leader could overcome the anxieties of parents and potentially make some changes, you know, in policy and approach that would perhaps after a bit of a bumpy transition become something sustainable and embraced? Do you think that's a possible future?
I mean, absolutely. We have examples of this. We have examples of this both nationally. Lyndon B. Johnson, right? You look at all the civil rights laws that get passed in the 1960s over heavy opposition, you know, the determination that this is the right thing to do. And now here we are 20 years later and no one would say, well, you know, 99% of the population would not say that black people should not be able to go into any restaurant or shopping center or park that they want to. But at that time, that was absolutely an aberrant thought. And we can look in schools, districts, for instance, like Wake County in North Carolina, where a community and its leadership and its business leadership decide this is the right thing to do, both economically, morally, socially, and they did it. And they did it for a long time. I think what we're seeing is this kind of silent complicity and an unwillingness to step out, even though he won, you know, Mayor de Blasio won, on a coalition of black and Latino voters who heavily supported him. So will it change overnight? No, but it becomes very easy for constituents to not work on this issue at all when they have no leadership whatever saying that this is the right and moral thing to do. Because clearly, you're never going to win on the argument that this is somehow like academically whatever. The only argument you're going to win this on is the moral argument, is that we know these are our values. These are our values as a city, and this is what we need to do. And if anything, like my piece, which is probably most investigative reporting is about morality and the right thing, but maybe not so explicitly said. But this piece is about what we're doing to children is immoral and our individual choices are actually immoral. And it would be nice to see the city's leadership acknowledge that instead of saying things like poor kids can be pen pals with rich kids or integration programs for children with autism. I mean, when you think about the language that they're using when clearly Carmen Farina knows the research on segregation and knows the research on how harmful it is to children. And we can't even have that conversation.
Tell us a little bit about the response once the piece came out. What have you been hearing?
Yeah, I've heard everything. I mean, the piece obviously struck a nerve. Something like 900 comments on the Times website. I've lost count of how many emails I've received. I mean, the comments typically of comments on stories really range. I never read a lot of them because it's not good for your mental health. But some people basically feel like they're like one step from calling Child Protective Services on me for sacrificing my daughter. People who took it very personal because they made a different decision and feeling like I was chastising them or judging them. But a lot of parents who have made a similar decision as I did, who said our children came out just fine. It was the best thing to do. It wasn't easy, but it was right. You know, my child just graduated from Yale after going to a school like this. You'll be fine, which was, I was very grateful for those. The most common message that I got, at least in my email, and of course, I think email just tends, even if people don't agree with you, it tends to be more civil because they're using their own email. They're actually contacting you as a person and not just posting on a comment. But it's people who said, like, I couldn't stop thinking about it because, you know, I made my choice for my child and now I'm, like, thinking about this because I saw it myself. Or I have a child who is going to be entering school and now I'm not able to think about my choice for her, him or her in the same way. Or people who said, like, my husband's and my arguments reflected the exact same arguments they were currently having, and that they were using, you know, my story to like say, see, look, like this is why we must do this. So I think probably the most gratifying part has been people who were like, they can't stop thinking about it, that they've been forced to confront something in themselves. And whether or not they'll change their decision or not, I think that's what we hope to do. At least that's what I hope to do with this. I don't expect the system to fall, but I want us to acknowledge the system we've built.
I found the end of the story incredibly powerful and, frankly, just very chilling. And I want to read the last paragraph. And just to set it up a little bit, it follows a paragraph you would talk to the parent of some children who ended up not going to 307, and he made a comment that his kid's not an experiment, though he did value diversity and would have liked to have had a more integrated situation for his children. So here's what you wrote. This sense of helplessness in the face of such entrenched segregation is what makes so alluring the notion, embraced by liberals and conservatives, that we can address school inequality not with integration, but by giving poor, segregated schools more resources and demanding of them more accountability. True integration, true equality, requires a surrendering of advantage, and when it comes to our own children, that can feel almost unnatural. Nigel's first 2 years in public school helped me understand this better than I ever had before. Even Kenneth Clark, the psychologist whose research showed the debilitating effects of segregation on Black children, chose not to enroll his children in the segregated schools he was fighting against. "My children," he said, "only have one life." But so do the children relegated to the city's segregated schools, you wrote. They only have one life, too. Now, reading that as a parent of a child in this school system, I came away with an incredible sense of weight on my shoulders and on the shoulders of educators in the city.
So I was successful.
How did you find that ending? How did you come to that ending?
I came across that Kenneth Clark passage fairly early in my research, and I knew it was going to go somewhere near the end because it just struck me as just the epitome of difficulty in the system. The thing that has always bothered me most about this is, as we keep saying we're going to find ways to fix it, you and I know that there are children in those schools. While we decide whether we're going to do the right thing or not, while we implement reform measure after reform measure, they're being cycled through and they're being deprived. And we want to feel okay with that because we're like, we're working on it. But the child who's graduating after 12 years of a failed education, it doesn't matter that you're working on it. And that we somehow accept that for these kids, it's okay to like wait while we figure it out, but certainly not for my kid. My kid better get the best of everything right now. I guess I feel like we either believe in the public and public education or we don't. We either believe that it's not about the individual good, but the societal good. It's not just about the good of my child, but the good of all children, or we don't. But there's not a halfway there. And I hope the whole piece shows that I understand that this is hard and a struggle. But in the end, there's only one right. I needed to end with a gut punch, really. I needed to end with something that would stick with you and you wouldn't walk away from the story kind of feeling like, yeah, this was really sad, but, you know, whatever. So it was really important for me to end with that. And in the end, bring it back to the reality that all these 10,000 words are about these children.
Right, right. Absolutely. Thanks so much for talking with us, Nicole.
Thanks, Heather.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. We'll be back next week.